We have a couple more people that are still dripping in, but let's get started. I have a couple of announcements I'm going to do, so excuse me while I... So, ordinarily I would do the announcements first and then introduce our speaker, but one of the announcements is our speaker too, and so I'm going to do that at the beginning. We are very lucky to have Professor Thomas Shapiro here with us today from Brandeis University. We've been talking about the cold in Boston already,
yes,
which is incredibly interesting how they deal with these problems over there. He's also director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy, and is in the Heller School for Social Policy
Correct.
And Management, is that right?
Correct.
So we're really thrilled to have Professor Shapiro here today. He's going to be talking to us about his recent book, which is excellent, by the way. I won't get the chance to say this on Thursday. Really important, insightful perspective on the intersections between class and race in the US and how wealth plays a central role in that. I think one of the things that I really love about the book as well is that it has really clear, sensible policy proposals for that context too, which is something that sometimes doesn't always come through in these conversations. So I think a really compelling read and has important things to say to our context in Europe and more broadly. So that's today, but we also then have Professor Shapiro on Thursday evening too. In a public event on this will be in the Hong Kong Theatre, 6:30 till 8. It will be chaired by Lucinda Platt, and we also are lucky to have someone from the Cabinet Office who is currently working on race and ethnicity in the UK as a kind of discussant to the book, but also offering some reflections on the UK context too. So I think that's going to be quite an exciting event. We're really glad that Tom could do that for us. We also have some other things coming up. We have our next seminar, will be on the 23rd of January. It will be Dr. Will Bartlett from the European Institute, and he will be speaking on inequality in the former Yugoslavian republics. Topic is not been discussed in this institute much to date, so it's going to be really important and interesting. And then after that, on the 25th of January, there's a kind of half-day event, and this is sort of a little bit long, so I'm going to read bits of this. But this is on neoliberalism, social oppression, and class relations. There'll be two parts to the day. There'll be from kind of 1 till, I think, 5:30, 1 till 6. It will be, is it here? 9:00? It's in Tower 2, in this room, right?
Yes.
In this room, there'll be Philippe Bourgeois will be speaking. We'll have Jeffrey Weber, Shelley Feldman, Tithi Bakahari, and Bev Skeggs. Participating in that, and then in the evening will be a separate session on the book Ground Down by Growth, which will have another bunch of wonderful and exciting LSE people. That will be in the Old Theatre from 6:30 till 8, so a full day of kind of really exciting discussion on those themes too. So I've talked way too much. Let's hand over to Tom. So if you can join me in welcoming Professor Shapiro.
Thank you very much. It is indeed an honor to be here, and I would first like to thank Aaron and John Hills and Billy and Liza for making my appearance here as seamless as it has been so far. And I now have not a duty to serve, but a mandate to perform. So I'm up here, and I'm going to take about 45 minutes or so and lay out some of the basic themes and findings from the recent book, Toxic Inequality, and then be able to open it up for a much deeper and engaged conversation about anything that arises and any questions. I will just say at the beginning that if you have a particular question about a graph or something, and I've got just 3 slides of graphs, feel free to, you know, ask what the data is or something like that, and hopefully I won't backtrack too much on that. So, the title of the book is Toxic Inequality, and I actually fought with the press. I fought with the editor to keep that title because they thought it would connote environmental damage. And the book would somehow not live up to what its cover was. But for me, the title, the concept of toxic inequality is really critical, especially in the context of the United States. And if I can just take, how many people here from the United States have spent any amount of time? Okay, thank you. Catch me as I go along here. Things are very different in the United States in terms of what we call, what I would like to call toxic inequality. And it's essentially a convergence that I wanted to separate the current era that we are in the United States as distinct and different and unique from virtually any other period of time post-slavery in the United States. And it has the uniqueness has the following characteristics: historic highs of both income and wealth inequality. Historic highs, at least back until prior to the Great Depression in the United States, the mid to late 1920s, and that's really as far back as we're able to go so far with wealth data. It's a little tricky on that. Income inequality, it is, we can say compellingly, it is at historic high. It's one thing for those of us that spend a lot of our passions and intellectual curiosity thinking about inequality, its sources, and how to ameliorate it. It's one thing to think about inequality when inequality exists in a period of economic growth, where there is some degree of mobility, that is, where the chances for families and individuals to get ahead is really palpable, experienced, and not just out of some statistical chart. Well, in the United States, we don't have that now. And I dare say that the United States is not a whole lot different than many other countries throughout the, at least the Western world in this aspect. Mobility, economic mobility, the ability of a family to move higher up on the socioeconomic ladder than its parents or grandparents has stalled. Now, that's obviously a general statement. For most of the population, it has stalled or actually declined. And then, clearly, for a much smaller part of the population, towards the upper middle and at the very, very top ends, it has continued to increase. Congruent with that, living standards, that is, the ability to buy more things, to buy more stuff for the money that is paid to workers, has also stagnated. And I'm going to show you a chart about that momentarily. So in a sense, we have the worst and the worst convergence of two different kinds of worlds. The world where absolutely income and wealth inequality has been increasing, widening, and is at historic highs at that same time where it's much more difficult for families to move ahead. And I think a lot of the politics comes from that particular kind of cross-section. And I'm going to add to that two or three other important features for the uniqueness of the United States, at least in a particular way. A widening racial wealth gap, and I will present some data on that in a few moments. Demographic changes. The demographers tell us, at least before President Trump was elected, that sometime in the year about 2042 or 2043, projections with birth rates and immigration and other features of demographic transition in the United States, by that year 2042 or 43, the United States will no longer have one ethnic or racial group that's a numerical majority. And that may reflect the demographics, for example, the state of California currently is like that. In that context, and clearly before the last presidential election in the United States with Clinton and Trump, pandering to racial anxieties and fears of immigration has been a consistent, constant part of the American political discourse, and clearly ratcheted up during the last presidential electoral campaign in the United States and subsequent to that. And I would be happy to entertain that conversation as we go along or at the end of the presentation about what some of that means. So I want to start with a couple of slides, and I want to start with this one about inequality. And it's a little mangled, but essentially I think it tells us the story of a great disjunction in the United States, where as wealth was being produced through productivity, up until about the early 1970s, 1971, 2 or 3, somewhere in there, that the wealth was somewhat equally shared in the wage, that is, the productivity. As the productivity went up, the hourly wage of the average worker went up basically on the same line. And then somewhere in that period of time, and obviously, not obviously, there are historical transitions at play that finally start to build that data, the great disjunction starts to occur, where wealth, the productivity, wealth continues to climb, impressively so in some circles, but the hourly compensation through the wage has stagnated. And that's where we see this great disjunction. So quickly, productivity rises between 1948, post-World War II, to early 1970s, about 97%. Hourly wage goes up also about 91%. But after 1973 or so, productivity goes up 238%, and the hourly compensation does continue to rise, but 109%. There are a lot of reasons for this, including the disorganization of organized labor in the United States, globalization we can talk about, and a number of other features that contribute to this. So how does this play out in terms of race and ethnicity in the United States? And I'm going to stop momentarily on this chart and the next one for a few moments, because I think they're really key to the kind of presentation that I would like people to think about and hear about in terms of the United States. So net wealth, everything a family owns minus all of its debts, everything it owns that has monetary value, minus all of its debts, including homes. The average, median, wealth of white families is about $171,000. You can do your own calculation to pounds. I don't know if that's impressive or not. That's at the median. That's at the 50th percentile. For African American families, the median family wealth at that 50th percentile is about $17,600. Another way of talking about that is the average African American family has a dime in wealth for every dollar of wealth that the average white family has. And for Hispanic families, that net wealth is $20,700. So it's about 12 cents on the dollar. All right. I'd like us to think about how does policy, how do institutional developments get us to a place in a society where a major demographic racial group has a dime in wealth for every dollar of wealth that the majority group has. And then the much greater difficulty in some ways, because we can intellectually parse it out, but moving forward, what kinds of policies? How do address that? How do we think about parity? How do you get from a dime to something close to parity? And just quickly, as a point of comparison, when we look at the average family income, black-white, it's about 60 cents on the dollar. So there's a great disparity there, but 60 cents on the dollar, I dare say, is horrible enough, but better than a dime on a dollar. All right. As you look at this chart, the chart comes from nationally representative data. So obviously there are data points representing millions of families and individuals on this particular chart. I'm going to telescope us in on one family so we can get a sense of how the data is accumulated here and what the data points actually mean. And it's a family, it's one of 187 families that were interviewed for the course of this book. Actually, the first set of 187 families were interviewed in 1998 and 1999. As the entry into the study, they all needed to have about five-year-old children because I wanted, among other things, to tap what their plans for the children's education were. As the family was growing, what their housing needs looked like, what they were thinking about communities. and a lot of other things. So I wanted it, we wanted a young kid in the family. We re-interviewed these families, at least 134 of them we were able to locate and agreed to be re-interviewed again 12, 13 years later in the period 2010, 2011, and there was a straggling of families in 2012. One of these families is headed by Patricia Arroyo. Patricia Arroyo is African-American. When we first talked to her in 1998, She was a single mom with two kids, and in the book I lie a little bit to hide the demographics. She actually had twin daughters, Brittany and Brianna, who were 5 years old, raising them by herself. Growing up in south central part of Los Angeles, a community called Watts, which is one of the hyper-segregated ghettos in the United States, a high concentration of poverty. There was a rebellion there, if you were, in 1965, if I recall the year correctly. Patricia's mother was on social welfare like Patricia was herself. And it's a story, it could be a story that ends there, about the perpetuation, the recycling of poverty, the passing on from one generation to another of welfare subsistence in the United States. But Patricia was I would dare say, like a lot of other individuals on social welfare in the United States, she wanted something better for herself and her family. And in fact, when we interviewed her, she had previously just completed a course, this is back in 1998, of learning computers, and had gotten an entry-level job for the County of Los Angeles in a public agency. It was a utility agency. And she was being paid, she was working now full-time, first full-time job in her life. She was being paid full-time wages, but the wages barely inched her family income above the poverty level in the United States. And back then, that was about $12,000 or $13,000. So she's raising a family with her twin daughters, herself, and she's trying to better her life. She had gotten that workforce development, which we call in the United States, gotten a full-time job, and was transitioning off of social assistance. But she didn't like the community of Watts that she was living in at all because of what she talked about, the lack of physical security that she felt for herself and her daughters. A lot of crime, mostly against people in the neighborhood, gangs, and drugs. And these were sort of her perceptions, which I think are not very far off. Patricia moves, and she moves to the western part of Los Angeles toward the Pacific Ocean to a place called Culver City, where she rents an apartment, moving further away, trying to find physical security for herself and her family, and also put her children in a catchment basin for a much better quality educational system. However, the apartment she rents is robbed while a niece is sleeping in one of the bedrooms. And she is, in that high academic term, she freaks out. She needs to move again. The neighborhood around her reminds her of Watts. Now, luckily, in a sense for her, at this point, she's now been working a couple of years. And she buys a home in the western part of Los Angeles, She buys a home through a program that, if we want to hear more about, ask me about it later. It's a program called Family Self-Sufficiency. Quickly, rents is subsidized in the United States for, it's means tested for families that qualify. You have to sign all kinds of agreements. You pay a rent according to how much your income is. So you earn more in the job, you go to two jobs, you get a full-time job, you get a raise, you pay more rent. Sort of an inverse scheme, in a sense, that provides a structural disincentive, perhaps, to doing better at work. So family self-sufficiency is a scheme that instead of one's rent going up, if you're in the program, that rent money is now put into an escrow account with one's name on it. And after you complete the program, and the goals have to be articulated, you sign all kinds of documents and papers, all the money that's built up in that account of that escrowed rent that you didn't have to pay is yours free and clear. Patricia buys a home. It's a policy, an astounding policy success story in a lot of ways. She buys a home in the western part of Los Angeles. And she buys a home before the foreclosure crisis. She buys a home in a hot real estate market of Los Angeles so that the home equity increases in value. Now, it's not money one can take out of a bank typically, but it's paper asset. It's a financial asset. In fact, for families like Patricia, who is now beginning to earn a middle income living in the United States, she acquires responsibilities at work, her pay raises, she starts to become part of the African-American middle class, single mom. Economically, she moves herself into that particular position. Two-thirds of the wealth of the broad American middle class between the 20th and the 80th percentile, two-thirds of the wealth is not in stocks or bonds. That's the Econ 101 fable. It's in the form of home equity. It's a profound institutional development and policy structured development in the United States and I dare say elsewhere. So virtually all of the wealth that Patricia Arroyo had was in the form of her home equity. She continues not to be impressed with the area she's living in, and I think partially psychologically where she grew up. She wants, you know, her quest is for physical security. Her quest is for green spaces. Her quest is for open ground. She ends up selling that house and buying a home in what we call the Inland Empire. It's a place about 100 kilometers from Los Angeles. It's a good hour's commute by private car in a development that is brand new housing development. All of the homes around her are, every third home looks architecturally exactly the same. It's one of those developments that occur in the Inland Empire in California and other parts of the United States. She buys that home by putting a huge down payment down. In fact, the down payment was about, as I recall from the interview, about $112,000. Almost all of her wealth. She plunks in as a down payment, so she then can afford the monthly fees, the monthly mortgage on the home. She's now moved herself and her daughter to a much safer community. But there are other problems involved. One is that she buys that home literally a couple of years before the Great Recession in the United States and the foreclosure crisis. That home plummets in value by about a half. On paper, she now has lost virtually all of her wealth. And after the second set of interviews we did with Patricia, she had described in the interview how about every other home in her neighborhood had a foreclosure sign on it, on the front lawn, or was palpably vacant, where the grass was growing wild or had burned out in the sun without it being watered. Every time I would go to Los Angeles, I'm based in Boston, I grew up in Los Angeles. Every time I would go to Los Angeles, I would do drive-bys of sort of ethnographically of the communities of some of the people that we had interviewed. A third of the interviews were taken from the Los Angeles area. The first time after that interview with Patricia, when I went by her neighborhood, my sociological eye, I saw exactly what she was talking about, where about every third home was vacant with a for sale sign or foreclosure sign on it. That's the sign of a community in grave crisis and where the housing values had plummeted. A few years later, my last visit there, that community had changed entirely. Patricia was still living there. And that's part of the story I want to get back to. She was still living there, but the market, the real estate market, had culled out the neighborhood. It had removed those suffering from the foreclosure crisis that could no longer afford their mortgages, and different families moved in at a lower price. So there were no more signs. The grasses were all green again. cars were parked in the driveway. It looked like a sort of a vibrant community. But Patricia had to meet her mortgage payments now by starting to put them on credit cards and starting to acquire debt. So part of the story about Patricia that I wanted to tell is that while we can look at a graph like that, that's static. And if we just put up Patricia's graph, it would be going up and down. Wealth doesn't change all that often. These are dramatic occurrences with the foreclosure crisis. But I wanted to give, you know, add a little motion to that snapshot that we look at in graphs like that. The other part of the Patricia story that is really important here is that the development that she lived in, and still does, was a development put up by a private developer called KB Homes. And KB Homes has a number of developments like this throughout the country. Homes that are relatively brand new, and they've made a whole lot of money on it, a whole lot of money on it. Part of what they do is offer a, quote, a full-service operation, meaning that they attach a potential home buyer to somebody, to a financial institution that will lend them money. In this particular development, the financial institution is called Countrywide Loans. Countrywide, for those three or four from the United States, it may ring a bell. If there's a poster child bank for the foreclosure crisis and predatory lending in the United States, the first one was Countrywide. In fact, it went belly up, it went underwater, and eventually was bought out by Bank of America, who assumed the assets and the liabilities with that. Predatory lending in the following way. Countrywide signed a consent decree with the Department of Justice of the United States government. A consent decree is basically saying, yes, I did it without pleading guilty. So there's no felony associated with it. But you stipulate to a number of findings. And the findings that Countrywide stipulated to was they had discriminated in lending terms against 200,000 African-American and Hispanic families in the state of California alone by offering them or steering them to terms of credit, terms of financing their home ownership at a much riskier rate. And we can talk about that later if people want to raise that question. Countrywide's not alone. Every single major financial institution in the United States, whether it's Bank of America, any bank you can name in the United States, of the top 10, every single one of them signed a consent decree with the Department of Justice of the United States government stipulating that they had discriminated against African-American and Hispanic families. And those are, for archival researchers, those are really interesting documents to look at, to see what the financial institutions actually stipulated to. All right, so Patricia's on that line, but it's an active, very much an active family. One of the questions that we wanted to get to in this, in a particular set of research, was say, okay, the racial wealth gap is a dime on a dollar, 12 cents on a dollar. It's impressively horrible. But we do live in the United States, and we've had very successful, hard-fought victories on the backs of a social movement, the civil rights movement, in the mid-1960s. So there are laws, national laws, about fair housing, fair lending, access to public services, and rights. And therefore, in the United States, a whole conversation has ensued about post-1960s, the United States has entered a post-racial society. Well, we wanted to interrogate that with some data, among other things. And the question we wanted to ask was, over a period of time, what's happened to the racial wealth gap? Not just comparing two cross-sectional samples, but what if we followed the same set of families over three decades? And the base year is 1984. It's not a trick year. It's simply the year in the panel study of income dynamics, which is one of the major longitudinal samples in the United States following the same set of families. 1984 is the first year that that questions about family wealth is asked. So, hypothesis for a methods, a research methods class. Hypothesis one might be a post-racial society would be, you would find a sign of evidence if the racial wealth gap maybe stays the same, maybe better if it closes. Negative evidence, negative data if the racial wealth gap increases. Same set of families experiencing American policy, American neighborhoods, American workplaces, American schools, although arguably not the same set of schools. So, the data. Adjusted for inflation, that is, the dollars are constant. 1984, the gap between white and black families is $84,000. By 2013, which is the last data point I'm going to present today, that gap, same set of families again, has tripled to $245,000. So something very profound is occurring in institutional policy legacy dynamics in the United States where that racial wealth gap doesn't even stay stable. It widens quite dramatically, I would suggest. And there's just one. There's actually one or two things I want to point out with this chart. One is that one of the statistical analyses we did. All right, so this is the African American wealth line, and this is the white wealth line. The Great Recession occurs somewhere in there. That's where we start to see the dip. Then it starts to go back up for white families in the study. We wanted to analyze the space in the middle. What accounts for the increasing space in the middle between the two lines? And that is, I think we were able to ask the question, what is driving, what are the major factors of widening the racial wealth gap? By far, the number one driver, and my, some of my great friends and colleagues always get me in trouble when I put it this way, so I'll back up on it. The greatest driver of the racial wealth gap is home ownership. And the capture here is the years of home ownership between 1984 and 2013. And that's not obvious. It's a proxy for the number of years that home equity could build up. Right. Now, what I get in trouble are the conversations that often incur. It's home ownership is a result of a lot of other things. It's wealth at time one. It's inheritance. It's what parents provide for down payments. There are a lot of things that go into home ownership in the United States. And it's not just home ownership by itself, but home ownership is the apex of a number of really important policy and family dynamics, and it's a major way that economic status is passed along, and it's a major way that wealth is passed along in the United States. All right, so the case that colleagues and I make, and by colleagues, I think it's important to understand a bit that at the Institute on Assets and Social Policy, we do this work primarily through grants and contracts, through foundation funding. And that means that we work, because of our mission, we work a lot with advocates. We work a lot with social movements. We often take research questions in conversations with advocates about what are the pieces of information that might add value to the policy you're trying to put forward. And then in the most rigorous, systematic fashion we can, we will, you know, investigate questions like that. So we tend to focus very much on policy and the ways in which inequality is preserved and generated by policy. I want to tick off a couple and back into one of them in a little more detail this early afternoon. tax policy actively the tax code of the United States government actively redistributes wealth to the top. From the middle, from the upper middle, to the tippy-tippy top. And I'm going to give you a piece of data on that momentarily. And at the same time, the intersection is that it also, at the same moment, the same source, intersects and widens the racial wealth gap. It provides a disincentive to savings. And the estate tax, which was recently gone through a worsening piece of regressive so-called reform in the United States. I'll also mention briefly momentarily. But what I want to back into is the mortgage interest deduction and the way it functions in the United States. But before doing that, just a little bit of data quickly on housing tenure by race and ethnicity, just looking at some major groups. So home ownership in the United States for whites is 39% plus 31%. 39% own their homes free and clear. That is, they're no longer paying mortgage. They're no longer paying a bank. They own it free and clear. 27% are renters. And for African Americans, you can see it's about 40% of home ownership or a little more. And 55% are renters. So the home ownership rate differs considerably in the United States by race and ethnicity. And it also differs, which is a new piece of information for most of us in the United States, when we look at data about who owns their home free and clear. That is, who is no longer, that 39% that is no longer paying, they've paid their mortgages off. So in the United States, let me not get there yet. The tax code, I'm going to walk around a bit. Am I okay with this, Billy? So in the United States, the typical way a home is bought before the Great Recession at least, but it's still the conventional way, a family will put down payment, that is with cash or savings or something, about 5 to 10% of the purchase price. And they will borrow the other 90 to 95% from a financial institution, usually on a loan for 25 to 30 years. 30 years, the conventional mortgage period in the United States. That was a big change that occurred in the middle 1930s. I won't get into that at the moment. But what is important to think about is that when a homeowner like myself, when I pay interest on the mortgage, because you're paying the balance, you're paying the principal, you're paying interest. Right? The interest on my mortgage and every other homeowner's, we can take off of our federal taxes, which means that it's a state subsidy to me to become a homeowner and every other homeowner that's still paying a mortgage on there. And it's calibrated. The amount I can take off of my taxes is calibrated by whatever my tax bracket is, that percent of the mortgage, of the interest I can take off. So the higher the income, the higher the percent of one's interest on the mortgage you can take off. Start to see how it operates in a regressive fashion. The bigger, the pricier the home is, the more the mortgage is going to be, the more I get to take off. So, what that means is that in the United States, every year about, and I use the term about, because it's sometimes tricky to get into the tax code and budgets there, about $205 billion, which is a lot of money, $205 billion is the federal subsidy to encourage and maintain home ownership, arguably families that would be homeowners anyways. Maybe the homes wouldn't be as big or as pricey, but we'd be homeowners anyways. Right. If one asks the question, what's the housing policy of the United States government? If we were to do a survey on the street, about 95%, my guess is, about 95% of the American population would say, well, the housing policy is rent subsidy. It's means tested. It's people on social welfare that soak off of those of us that can afford it. And that's the housing policy of the United States government. If budgets talk, that's not the housing policy. We spend approximately $40 billion a year in the United States on means-tested rent subsidization in the United States. $40 billion is a big number. It's for people that can't afford housing, that allow them into housing. And the contrast to that is we invest $205 billion to subsidize home ownership. Now, it's one thing to think about if that $205 billion subsidy is somewhat equitably distributed, but because of the mechanisms I talked about and others, the top 10% of income earners amass 86% of the mortgage interest deduction subsidy. Right, so massive subsidy, that's what I mean by the tax code and policy actively redistributing wealth to the top. If there were equity, mechanical equity, if you will, by numbers, African Americans make up 12.8% of the population and, according to our calculations, receive about 6.2% of the mortgage interest deduction tax code subsidy. That means that for African Americans, there is approximately close to $5 billion, and for Hispanic families, about $4.1 billion directed away from those families if that policy approached anything we might call equity or parity. So let me switch gears a little bit and throw out some ideas for us to think about. And I'm not sure how wonky we want to get with an audience that's primarily not from the United States. But let me throw out some things that we think about and actively try to drive forward in the United States. For me, one of the most important aspects is to begin to think seriously about embedding racial justice filters for policy. That is, to begin to ask the questions. When a policy is proposed, how does it impact whites? How does it impact African Americans? How does it impact Hispanics? And whatever other racial and or ethnic groups we want to talk about. We do this somewhat in the United States when we think in terms of economic, socioeconomics and class. We do this somewhat by thinking about what the impact of a policy is on which income band. But we don't do it in terms of race and ethnicity. The institute I direct, we actually have developed something we call the Racial Wealth Audit that is a framework that allows us to do this, at least when we're able to get the data. So number one in moving policy forward is to begin to embed and to think about racial justice filters or equity filters. And I will just say parenthetically here that a number of large municipalities in the United States, Seattle, Boston, Buffalo, and a few others, New Jersey, have begun to implement and think about embedding racial justice and equity filters in municipal policy. How's procurement done? How is hiring done? How do you determine which streets get repaired? Is every street equal, or do you go by need? Those kinds of questions are starting to be driven by advocates and some champion policymakers into the policy sector. The other two other ways forward I'll talk about, and then I want to open this up for a much broader conversation. My second to last bullet point here is what we call reconnect work and wealth. We have a concept that we call employment capital in the United States. And it's essentially an understanding that the primary way that wealth used to be created was through work, was through decent wages, was through protecting families from not spending wealth. Was that me?
think it was just...
Am I banging the podium?
Yeah, you're top thumping. No, I think it's obviously just not... It's
okay. Yeah, my talks are never stable. Reconnecting the pipeline, the escalator, if you will, between work and wealth, and that I would suggest in the United States has been disconnected by employers and by the state, primarily through the dwindling and withering away of retirement savings, where employers no longer offer retirement savings, much less seed them, much less match them. So as just a quick example, myself, I work in a large university, have worked in universities in the private sphere. The university I work at and the one previously they mandated me into a system. I had no choice. And the system they mandated me into was that they were going to take 5% of my paycheck and put it into an account with my name on it, retirement account. And for every dollar that they mandated from me, they were going to put in 2. So 5% of my check I never see, and they put in another 10%. Now, I've been working in universities for a long time. That grows. And I won't give a figure. It's stupid. A figure doesn't make any sense to anybody. The figure doesn't mean that Tom Shapiro has been smart and thrifty and not consumed and done all those things that we think we've learned in Econ 101 about marginal propensities to save and consume and invest and be thrifty and all that. It's entirely institutional. It's entirely policy. And that 5% of my salary and the 10% in addition the university adds is not taxed, at least until I retire and pull out of that system. That's employment capital. That's part of what's been disconnected in the United States. It, among other things, where the United States is unfortunately an outlier in that there's no paid maternity leave, there's no paid sick leave in most workplaces. Health insurance and dental insurance used to be offered to a much higher degree and more of it paid for by employers. All of those things that protected wealth, that protected savings, now savings have to be used for maternity, paternity leave, and the first infancy of a child. Sick leave often is out of one's own pocket. And health insurance, a greater proportion of it, is being paid by the individual worker. Right. Economic mobility stalled. Living standards stagnating in the United States. I want to end with Patricia's daughters. I want to get us back to Patricia Arroyo and Brittany and Brianna. Brittany was, in high school, she was a track star. And because she was a track star, she was able to get a scholarship to a state university in California. And I don't know if she graduated or not. Since the last interview, I've not been in contact. But her higher education was paid for, which might mean that the middle class status that her mother, Patricia, earned her way into, that's the transmission belt for passing that along. That education may get her employment at the same middle-class income level that provides that kind of standard of living for herself. Her twin sister, unfortunately, has juvenile diabetes. She was not a track star. Her grades were middling at the C level, where her sister, the track star, was an A-minus student. Her sister didn't get a scholarship, and her sister wasn't going to college right away. She was going to work. And those dynamics often don't play out that divergently within one family, but that's the sense of how economic mobility and immobility and living standards are passed along, I suggest, not only in the United States, but elsewhere. And I was struck by connecting a recent study done by Raj Chetty and associates, where the subtitle is what I call Lost Einsteins. And it's kind of an ingenious little study where the proxies and the surrogates might not all be right, but it's a good story. What he did was, what the team did, was they went to the patent office of the United States government, and they were using patents as inventions. You could patent, no one could use the same thing for X period of time. You had the exclusive right. They used patents as a proxy for innovation. And they then asked the question, who got patents? And they went back to, because they were able to bring in long-term data, they were able to go back to families, and they were looking at kids with high math scores in elementary school in the first few years of public or private schooling. Kids with high math scores, white, black, Hispanic. And then looked at who got patents. And what they found was that there was a higher rate of getting patents for whites when they were kids who had middling or low math scores, had a higher rate of getting patents, being innovative, if you will, than children of color that had high math scores. And Raj Chetty and associates make the argument, you know, among the arguments we make and the narratives and frames we talk about with inequality, the moral argument about what a society is losing and the macro argument about what a society is losing. And I want to suggest that the levels of inequality that we have reached in the United States and elsewhere is resulting in lost Einsteins, not just for the individuals, communities, and families, but for the societies at large. So thank you very much, and our hope is to recover the Einsteins.